We hope this message from Word of Life Church is a blessing to you.
Mark chapter 12, I'll start reading in verse 28. Mark 12, 28. And one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, "Which commandment is most important of all?" Jesus answered, "The most important is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these.'" Let me set the scene for you a little bit. Jesus has been teaching, and his teaching has brought him great popularity. There are people that are seeking after him because they hear from him and they see in him truth. And so they're drawn to that. They're attracted to Jesus. And so there are Pharisees who have already come to Jesus and they're trying to trap him. They're threatened by what he is saying, so they're trying to catch him in this little trap. So they pull this thing about paying taxes. They figure if we can trap a preacher, we'll do it by talking about taxes. And so they are talking about paying taxes to the Caesar, to the Roman Empire, and should we do this or not? And Jesus kind of gives them an unexpected answer, and he has them pull out a coin, and whose face do you see on that? Well, we see Caesar, and then he says, "Well, you render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but unto God what is God's." And they're like, "Ah, oh, we missed him." Then there are these Sadducees that are gathered, and they're trying to, well, they're just trying to prove him wrong. The Pharisees and Sadducees were just different religious groups within Israel at the time. And the primary difference with the Sadducees is they didn't believe in bodily resurrection. And that was what identified them and separated them, made them different. So they were trying to prove Jesus wrong on the resurrection. So they ask a question about a woman whose her husband has died and she gets remarried. And then the next husband dies and she gets remarried. And the next husband dies, she gets remarried. The question really there is, why are all those husbands dying? But the point they're trying to make... No jokes tonight. Serious. But the question that they then ask, okay, this woman's been married multiple times and widowed many times. In the resurrection, who will she be married to? They thought, well, we can prove that Jesus got this whole resurrection bit all messed up. But he says, well, in the resurrection, we'll be like the angels. We're not given into marriage. Oh, the Sadducees, they missed it. They're frustrated. So then comes this scribe, this keeper of the law, and he has a question to ask Jesus. Now, this scribe, I don't want to cast in a negative light. I don't think that this scribe was some kind of rule-keeping legalist. I think he was a seeker. And I think he's heard Jesus respond to the Pharisees and respond to the Sadducees with truth that caused people to marvel. And so he says, now it's my turn to ask Jesus a question. And so he says, what is the greatest commandment? And again, I don't think he's trying just to keep the rules. I don't think he was a rule-keeping hypocrite. I don't think he was just like, well, Jesus, just tell me what I got to do so I can be a good follower of Yahweh. I think this scribe was a seeker of truth. I think he really wanted to know. He wanted to live a life of obedience, pleasing to God. So he asks. And so Jesus answers from the Jewish Shema, which you can find in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Something that was very central and remains very central to Jewish worship and prayer, the Shema. Shema is Hebrew. It just means hear. It's the first word of what Jesus said from Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. And then it follows, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And Jesus adds to the Shema from Leviticus, from the Levitical law, the command to love your neighbor as yourself. And so Jesus weds these two commands together and says there are no other commands greater than these. To love God, to love neighbor. Now Jesus says, in quoting from Deuteronomy, that in loving him, we should do it with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And I think that we should take those four as a whole thing. I think that was the original meaning. I don't think we are necessarily supposed to divide those things up. Well, what is my heart and what is my mind? No, I think heart, soul, mind, and strength is just another way of saying, with everything that you have, you are to love God. That is the chief command. With everything within you, all your inside stuff, with everything you have, your entire life should be in love with God and demonstrating love for God. So this should be taken as a whole, because Jesus, after all, said that our love for God should make all other loves look like hate in comparison. He actually said that if we wanted to be his follower. In Luke 14:26, Jesus says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. I wonder if Focus on the Family knows this verse is in the Bible. How do they deal with that? I don't think Jesus is saying literally to be his followers, you have to hate your family. Certainly not. Jesus wouldn't cause us to break the command to honor our mother and father. Certainly not. What he's saying, he's using exaggeration to make this point, that our love for God should be burning so bright that every other kind of love looks like hate. To love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It should be taken as a whole, but I do want to focus on just two of those tonight. So I'm kind of breaking my own rule. I'm just saying you should take them all as a whole. And there, sometimes we can do danger in trying to compartmentalize those things too much. But I think that there is a nugget of truth to be found if we just talk about loving God with our mind and loving God with our strength. So that's what I want us to focus on. What would it mean? What would it look like for us to love God with all of our mind? What would it look like to love God with all of our strength? And where is the convergence of those two? Let's start with loving God with our mind. Let me give you this thought. Loving the Lord with all our minds requires us to think. Mm-hmm. Loving God with all of our minds requires of us that we think, that we become thinking people. If we choose to reject this, if we choose not to become thinking people or to develop our abilities to think, we can actually be separated and alienated from the life of God. And I don't mean that by exaggeration. The scripture is extremely clear that your thinking or the lack thereof can separate you from the life and power of God. It's in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 17. Now this I say, Paul's writing, now this I say and testify in the Lord that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding and alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. So what is it that alienates them from the life of God? Their minds have been dark. Their minds are clouded with darkness. Darkness is a harsh term, don't you think? And yet it dominates the things I see. So what alienates them from God, according to Ephesians 4, is not their behavior, although that certainly can alienate you from the life of God. It was that their minds were darkened, their understanding, they lack the ability to think rightly and clearly about God. And that grew out of, Ephesians says, their hearts being hardened. Do you notice there that heart and mind, there's a connectedness there? That the lack of being able to think clearly, that cloudiness and darkness of mind was connected to the heart. Because that's the way that we are. We are very complex, interrelated beings. And what modern people want to do is dissect our innards, and not just physically, but they want to dissect the inside stuff, the immaterial parts of us, to understand them as separate pieces. But it doesn't work that way, because our hearts and our minds and our creativity and our imagination and our conscience and our emotions and our volition and even our physical bodies, the outside stuff, it's all interconnected and woven together. So that we're a whole being. And yes, there are times when there are certain parts of your inside stuff that gets out of whack and you need to give attention to that. But it's very modernistic to want to divide those things. They're connected. And so here, the warning is, don't allow your minds to stay in that cloak of darkness. Because if you resist becoming a thinking person, you can be alienated from the life of God. This is one of the problems in the church in the West, in the church in America, in churches like ours, in evangelical, non-denominational churches. It's one of our problems. And some of our best writers and teachers and prophets are telling us that. N.T. Wright, in his book, After You Believe, points this out, that this unwillingness to become thinking people and to grow in the intellectual life, N.T. Wright says, is one of our problems. And I would say that N.T. Wright, or you can call him Tom Wright, sounds disrespectful, but some of us read so much and listen to so much N.T. Wright, we feel like he's our friend Tom. He probably is. I think I could make a good case that he's the most important theological voice in the world. I don't think that's an exaggeration. Pastor Brian says amen, and that's all I need. Yeah. You may not know this, but N.T. Wright's that important. He really is. He really is. Everybody is reading N.T. Wright. Not just churches like ours. I mean, all sorts of different types of Christians. Everybody listens to N.T. Wright. And I think it's helpful that he's British. Because anyone who speaks in a British accent sounds more intelligent than I do, for one. But it's helpful for a Brit to look across the pond and just survey American Christianity. And I think he's speaking about us, Yanks, us Americans, but he doesn't, in his book, After You Believe, he doesn't talk about American Christianity. He uses the term contemporary Christianity. But this is what N.T. Wright says. He writes, "Part of the problem in contemporary Christianity, I believe, is that talk about the freedom of the Spirit, it has been taken over surreptitiously by a kind of low-grade romanticism, colluding with an anti-intellectual streak in the culture, generating the assumption that the more spiritual you are, the less you need to think." This, Tom says, is a problem, and I would agree. Now, you got to really be present in the moment when you're reading N.T. Wright, because there's these long sentences. But here's what he says. The problem in contemporary, present-day, and I think he would say American, Christianity, is that there is this low-grade romanticism, a romanticizing of the faith that has blended with an anti-intellectual streak, that is a refusal to grow intellectually. It is merged together and produced a lie that says the more spiritual you are, the less you have to think. And I think he's right on. Yeah. Someone was asking me recently about this romanticizing of the faith. What does romanticizing of the faith really mean? And I would say romanticizing your faith means to take one element of your faith and exaggerate it to a point that your faith no longer looks like the faith of the Bible. It's a gross exaggeration. So to romanticize your faith, just think of marriage, right? Your marriage as a whole. Your marriage does not look like a romance novel, right, that you pick up at the grocery store. Now, I have never read a romance novel. I never have. But I have peeked because I've been curious. I've heard people poke fun. And so I've peeked. I just kind of flipped through a couple of pages. But you've heard. You have friends who have read these kind of novels, right? What those novels are is a romanticized view of marriage. It's not a picture of what marriage is really like. Now, is there a romantic element to your marriage? Absolutely. Right? But you husbands don't walk into the door and glide over to your wife and embrace her. And please tell me you don't do that. If I did that, Jenny would give me the Heisman Trophy stiff arm. You're like, get out of here. What are you doing? So when we refuse to be thinking people, and we reject all that, what we end up doing is taking our relationship with God and making it a me and Jesus kind of spirituality and being all in love with Jesus. Oh, I love Jesus and me and Jesus. And we romanticize that individual personal relationship to the point that our faith life no longer looks like the faith of the saints of old, the faith that we read about in Scripture. And so these things have colluded, and it's produced this lie, Tom tells us, that the more spiritual you are, the less you have to think. He goes on to say, I cannot stress too strongly that this is a mistake. Thinking clearly and Christianly is thus both a key element within the total rehumanizing process and a vital part of the motor which drives the rest of that process. This rehumanizing process is what we call discipleship. Making people disciples of the Jesus way, putting people in places where the Spirit transformed them to look more like Jesus. And N.T. Wright says, and the motor that drives this is thinking clearly and Christianly. Or we could say, loving the Lord with all of our minds. And if we resist this, and if we reject it, we run the risk of alienating ourselves from the very life of God. That is no exaggeration. Think about it this way. The God that we worship is holy, right? We know that. We get that. We pray that. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. We sing those songs. You understand that. But when we say that God is holy, we're not saying that God is religious. We're saying that God is different. He is separate. He is other than his creation. He is creator. We are created. And there's something different. He is altogether different than his creation. So if God is going to be that different, what that means is there is really nothing in all of creation that can accurately represent what he is like. Now, we work hard to try to build those bridges. And so we talk about God being our rock and God is a shepherd and God has arms. And we use these metaphors to try to get at this God that we worship. But he is altogether separate, different, wrapped in mystery. And so if we are going to seriously pursue him, then we just have to expect that it's going to require work mentally to understand this God that we're worshiping. So he is altogether other. He is holy, separate, and different. And yet we have been given this gift, the ability to think, the ability to ponder. And so that's what we want to do in making disciples, is we want to challenge people to grow in this area of loving God with all of your mind. And you've been given that ability. You can do that. So we start with loving God with all of our mind. That's a part of that great command. But there's also loving God with all of our strength. Let me give you another thought. Loving the Lord with all our strength requires us to strive. To strive. You know the word strive, it means to devote serious energy and attention. To strive. This is not talking about when the Bible says to love the Lord with all of your strength, that strength is not physical strength. It's not intellectual strength, but it's emotional energy. It's hard to define what that is. It's that oomph, it's that intentionality that we add. Right. So we're called to love the Lord with all of our minds. That requires us to think. And we are also called to love the Lord with all of our strength, which requires us to strive. Jesus encouraged us to do that very thing, to strive. There was a time Jesus was asked another question. He's always asked questions. A lot of his teachings are just a response to questions he was asked. And once he was asked, Jesus, will the number of people that are going to be rescued when the kingdom comes, is that going to be a lot of people or a few amount of people? I mean, will there be a lot of people rescued or just a little? And so Jesus gives this response. In Luke 13, 24, he says, strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. So this guy's asking the question. He's just trying to get an account here and an expectation. How many people will be rescued in this kingdom that is coming? And Jesus said, to a response to him was not a number, but rather to strive. To strive to enter into this narrow, constricted way. And then he says that there will be many that seek to enter and they won't be able. And so then Jesus begins to flesh out the answer in a bit of a story. It's somewhat of a story and it's somewhat of a prophecy. And so, and it's here in Luke 13, and I want to read it to you from Eugene Peterson's The Message Bible. Eugene Peterson's translation is really good at the stories. He gets the stories really good. Peterson is very mindful of story and storytelling. And so I'm just going to read it, this story prophecy that Jesus gives an answer to the question, how many will be rescued? I want to read it to you from the Message Bible so you can catch the story here. So this is in Jesus' response. He says, put your mind on your life with God. The way to life, to God, is vigorous and requires your total attention. Vigorous, that's striving. That's loving God with all your strength. A lot of you are going to assume that you'll sit down to God's salvation banquet just because you've been hanging around the neighborhood all your lives. Well, one day you're going to be banging on the door, waiting to get in, but you'll find the door locked and the master of the house saying, sorry, you're not on my guest list. And you'll protest, but we've known you all of our lives, only to be interrupted by his abrupt, your kind of knowing can hardly be called knowing. You don't know the first thing about me. That's when you'll find yourselves out in the cold, strangers to grace. You'll watch Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the prophets march into God's kingdom. You'll watch outsiders stream in from east and west and north and south and sit down at the table of God's kingdom. And all the time, you'll be on the outside looking in and wondering what happened. This is the great reversal. The last in line put at the head of the line and the so-called first ending up at the last. This person wants to know a number, but Jesus reveals something bigger, something greater. And that there is a kind of knowing God that is all mind and no strength. That's what Jesus reveals in the story. That there is, and that's the kind of knowing I think he's talking about. When he says, your kind of knowing can hardly be called knowing, I think he's talking about the kind of knowing that is all mind and no strength. No vigor, no emotional energy, no intentionality, no oomph. It's all just information. A kind of knowing that just assimilates and gathers and collects God facts, but has no direct encounter with God, no emotional energy put forth in the pursuit of God. It's just gathering God facts to catalog so that when St. Peter opens the pearly gates, you'll have the right answer. And Jesus said that your kind of knowing, you might call it knowing, but it's not the kind of knowing that puts you in contact with me. All mind and no strength produces a kind of knowing where you have all the God facts, but you invest little energy in actually knowing God. And see, if it's just loving God with all of your mind, if you only do that with none of this loving God with your strength, it will turn you into a know-it-all, Bible-thumping, Bible answer man or woman. So that you have all the Bible answers, right? You can answer all the questions, you can do the Bible trivia, and you'll win every time. You have all that God facts in your head, but you don't know God at all. And again, notice what Jesus said to those that if it's only mind, if it's only that kind of knowing, he said, you'll be knocking at the door, and the master of the house will say, you're not on the guest list. I don't even know you. And you'll be, I like the way Eugene Peterson translates it. So you'll be out in the cold, strangers to grace. See, Ephesians 4 says, and you'll be alienated. You can be alienated from the life of God if you're not rightly loving him with your mind, and you can be alienated from the life of God if you are not loving him with emotional energy and strength. These two have to be wedded together. If your faith journey is mind only, if it's intellectual only, what that produces is stoicism. Stoics. You know that word. You've heard that. We use that word to talk about people who are emotionless. You know, oh, he's just being stoic because he's not showing any kind of emotion. But stoicism, just let me take a little side journey, give you a little background. Stoicism is actually an ancient Greek philosophy, dates back to the 3rd century BC. And at the time of Jesus, in the Roman Empire, stoicism was a dominant philosophy. And when I say philosophy, I mean a religion, a way of living life. And the Stoics believed that the good life, the virtuous life, the happy life, was found in self-control. Because what they would say is that there are these destructive desires that pull happiness away from people. So the way to pursue happiness and to find a happy life and to find a good life is to be in control of your emotions and desires. And so for the ancient Stoics, they were not interested in extinguishing all desires, just remaining in control, not being dominated by destructive desires. Well, this caused the early church to be interested in Stoicism. The early church fathers, they saw there were some similarities between the Christian faith and Stoicism. We both believe that there are these destructive desires of lust and greed and pride that steal away from the happy life. But at the end, the church fathers said, this is a pagan religion. Because for the Stoics, there was no personal God. Their view was God is nothing more than just the created order. And so for them, the universe and nature itself was God. It was a pantheistic religion. That is, God is nature and God is in everything. So it was pagan in that sense. And so they rejected it because there was no belief in Jesus, no belief in Jesus' resurrection. And they, Stoics, would just laugh at the idea of bodily resurrection at the end of this age because they believe there's nothing after death. I thought you got this one life, it's right now, and when you die, you're dead like a dog in the ground. And so quickly, the early church fathers recognized, while there's some value in Stoic philosophy, it is not the truth that we see in Jesus. You know, you even see the Stoics at one place in the scriptures. Paul, when he's on Mars Hill and he's debating the philosophers, he's debating a Stoic philosopher. And what causes the debate is he's talking about Jesus and the resurrection. This is in Acts 17, verse 18, where it says, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. That's Paul. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? And others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. That's what Paul was preaching, Jesus and the resurrection, Jesus and the resurrection. And so the Stoics were like, what is this babbler talking about? This man, this carpenter from Nazareth being God, this resurrection, they thought was just foolishness. So this ancient Stoicism, very popular in the Roman Empire. As you understand, an empire fueled by war and armies, Stoicism was very popular among them. And so Stoicism remained around until about the 5th, 6th century, and then it kind of died out until the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment. In the 1600s and the 1700s, there was a revival of Stoicism, people returning to that, because the Enlightenment in Europe was called the Age of Reason. That was the shift that was happening from what we call the medieval time to the modern period, to the season of Enlightenment. And this was the 18th century, the 1700s. If you think back to your history, there was a nation that was being formed during that time. So we are living in a nation that was growing up at the time when philosophies like Stoicism were gaining popularity, because the Stoics put so much emphasis on the power of reason, that you can control yourself and so have a happy life by controlling the passions by the power of reason. So it's in the air that we breathe. It's all around us, this idea that, well, if you just can control yourself and be calm and find the power of reason, then you can find a happy life. And I see that it seeps into the church, especially whenever we put an emphasis on loving God with all of your mind. Again, if it's mind only, the result is Stoicism. So when Christians want to be more serious and more studious and grow in their loving the Lord with all their mind, there's always a temptation of this Stoic kind of spirituality, where we just kind of pull back emotionally and we put everything into our ability to think. And we have to guard ourselves against that, because this is what I see that I think will help you, is that we need a convergence of mind and strength. We need to wed together loving God with all of our minds and loving God with all of our strength. We need both. And we need them to converge as we gather in worship, and we need that to converge in our life of faith and pursuing God. So we should both be people who are thoughtful about our faith and emotionally invested, or we say passionate emotionally about what we believe. We need both. Because if it's mind only, it leads to Stoicism. If it is strength only, with no mind, it leads to fanaticism. These are the two ruts. If we don't have a convergence of both, you end up with either a Stoic kind of Christian faith, which is not the faith we see in the scriptures or in church history. And if it is strength only, emotional energy only, and no mind, it leads to fanaticism, religious fanaticism. Fanaticism is hard to define, but we usually know what we mean by fanaticism when we see it. But let me kind of give you a working definition. This is sort of my definition of religious fanaticism. That is, when it's no mind, it's not thinking a thoughtful kind of faith, it's just feeling and emotion and energy and passion. If it's only that, produces religious fanaticism. Here is a kind of working definition, my definition. Religious fanaticism occurs when people uncritically give excessive attention and emotional energy to some object of devotion. Now, I want to work with that for just a second. You got to be present. You got to think. All right, work with me. Religious fanaticism occurs. This is what it looks like. It's when people uncritically give excessive attention and emotional energy to some object of devotion. Now, giving attention to an object of devotion is a good thing, right? The object of our devotion is Jesus Christ. And so to give him attention, very important. What produces religious fanaticism is when it's excessive attention and it's uncritical. When I say uncritical, what I mean by that is it's not without proper thought. When I say uncritical, I don't mean it's not being critical. By uncritical, I mean it's without thought. Does it make sense? So you can see a number of examples in the world we live. We could look at the radical, militant wing of Islam, and we can see suicide bombers that will strap bombs to their bodies. Bodies and lives that were created in the image of God. And they'll blow themselves up in the name of religion. We can call that religious fanaticism. Now, the thing with fanaticism is it's a subjective term. That is, what I would call fanaticism, other people would call it truth. So it requires a bunch of people together to determine what is fanaticism and what isn't. But you think about that suicide bomber for a second. What they're doing makes no sense. They are uncritically giving all attention to this awful idea of jihad, of holy war, of bringing awareness of their religion by violence and death, by killing themselves and other people. It's fanaticism. It's you're just not thinking. Not thinking critically. So it'd be easy to pick on other religions. Let's pick on our own religion for a second. Sometimes it's easier maybe to see fanaticism in our own house than it is just to point fingers at those out there. I see religious fanaticism in our ranks, in our family, as followers of Christ, when people give too much attention to the mystical side of Christianity. Now, there is a mystical side. Mystical simply means direct encounter. So a mystical Christianity is nothing more than an experiential encounter with God as revealed in Jesus Christ. Now, we believe that you can have a direct encounter with God. So there is mysticism to the faith. But there are those, they don't want to love the Lord with all of their minds. They only want to love the Lord with all of their strength. And they give too much attention to the mystical side of their faith. And you know you've encountered these people. These are the kind of people that, you know, talk about, well, God told me. These are the people that hear the voice of God in their heads like 20 times a day. You know, so they get up and, yeah, well, God told me to wear brown shoes and a black belt. And I told the Lord, I said, no, I need to wear a black belt with black shoes. That's what you do. But the Lord said, no, today I want you to wear brown shoes and a black belt. The Lord told me that. And then I went downstairs and the Lord told me to eat oatmeal. And I really wanted to just make eggs, but the Lord said oatmeal. So I did that. And then the Lord said, well, you're getting late for work. You got to get in your car. No, these are the kind of people that they hear God speaking in their head over and over and over. Now, do you have the ability to hear from God? Absolutely. Is God going to tell you what color of belt to wear and what to have for breakfast? Probably not. Probably not. It reminds me of a time I was talking to a guy about his faith, just talking about faith journey, talking about stories, and he was in a difficult spot, and he began to just tell me his story, and I just took mental note that his story, that his part of the conversation was peppered with God told me, and God told me, and God told me, and God told me. I mean, I really try to be careful in my own life. I just try to be careful with not using too loosely the phrase, God told me. Because if you've walked with the Lord at any length of time, and I've been walking with the Lord 20 plus years, I'm going to be honest. There's times I thought I heard God talking to me, and it wasn't God. All right. So I try to be careful. But I noticed that he was saying that a lot. Well, yeah, this happened, and God told me, and this happened, and God told me, and God told me, and God told me, and God told me, and God told me I was going to have a great healing ministry, and that the healing power of God was going to rest on me. But everyone I pray for who's terminally ill dies. And so I said, well, perhaps, maybe, could it be possible? Now, I believe in the healing power of God. I believe Jesus is a healer. I believe God has made a covenant of healing with us. I believe God answers prayers of faith by healing people. I also believe that ultimate healing takes place in the resurrection when we get a brand new body. So I believe, and I believe God can speak. I believe there's healing power and we can pray for sick people. But I said, but perhaps, but just maybe, that what you thought was God talking to you wasn't. And I remember he had the strangest look on his face, just dumbfounded. And he abruptly ended the conversation, said, you haven't helped me at all, shook my hand, and that was it. He was done with me. He was walking out. And I was not trying to be unkind. I was not trying to belittle him, because this was not a bad guy. This is a good guy. This is a guy who I believe was sincere in seeking to pursue God. But for him, he unknowingly had fallen into this trap of religious fanaticism, where God was talking to him 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 times a day. And when I tried to present something that was very reasonable, I even gave him a story of when I thought God was talking to me, he wasn't. I'd tell you that story, but choosing not to. You got those stories. You know that's happened. You thought, yeah, I thought God was leading me into this, and it was just my imagination. It wasn't God at all. So I was just trying to present to him just another way of thinking, and it was just boom, done. I don't want to hear it. Because he was sincere, but he hadn't found that convergence of loving God with all of his mind and all of his strength. And so we need this. We desperately need this. And so wherever you find yourself on that spectrum, think of it as a spectrum, because you have to hold these things in tension. Loving God with all of your mind, loving God with all of your strength, with emotional energy. I don't know where you are in that tension on that spectrum. But whichever side you find yourself on, you got to find a way to bring them back together. So if you are growing in your ability, in your capacity to think, and you're growing in loving God with all of your mind, don't forget, you also have to love them with all of your strength. Because we don't want you to turn into a stoic. We want you to be a Christian. And if you are in a place where, man, you're loving God with all your strength, strength's not your problem, you can't even spell stoicism, let alone understand what it is. You're totally lost. You're like, I need to grow in the area of loving God with all my mind. I encourage you to take steps in that direction, because I don't want you to be a fanatic. I want you to be a Christian. Yeah. I think this convergence should take place anytime we're gathered together. In our worship gatherings, Friday nights, Sunday mornings, that should be a convergence. You know, and I stumbled upon this idea of this convergence and especially this the energy, the emotional energy from reading the Psalms. I don't know if you've noticed this, but in so many of the Psalms have exclamation points to them. For example, let's take Psalm 134. If you got a Bible, go there. And I'll tell you what, Pastor Eric, if you will come, I'm going to wrap up with this. I'll tell you what, if you and the whole worship team would come, let's do that Be Still song again. Can we do that? All right, great. Psalm 134. See, every time we gather in worship, it should be a time of convergence in loving God with mind and strength. And you know, we do that. We ask you to stand and be still and listen to someone read a whole chapter of Scripture. I know some of you are like, I don't like doing that. It's boring. You know what it does? It challenges you. I know it challenges you. You know why it challenges you? I know it challenges you because it challenges me to focus in and just listen and be present and just control your mind. Train your mind just to listen to the Scriptures being read. So we have that. We have music that helps produce the energy. And then we have Scripture reading. And of course, the preaching that happens here is to cause us to love the Lord with all of our minds. So we have both of those. But I've noticed in the Psalms how many exclamation points there are. And there is truth in the exclamation point. Now, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. I'm picking Psalm 134 simply because it's short. There's three verses. But you can see the exclamation points. Now, if you have a King James Bible, no exclamation points. But what's interesting is the New King James got exclamation points. NIV, no exclamation points. But the Revised Standard Version and the New Revised, exclamation points. And the ESV, which normally gets it right, exclamation points. But just notice. And for those of you who pay attention to punctuation, which you should, punctuation's important. When you read a sentence with an exclamation point, you read it differently. So Psalm 134, verse 1, come, bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord who stand by night in the house of the Lord. Lift up your hands to the holy place and bless the Lord. May the Lord bless you from Zion, he who made heaven and earth. Exclamation point. Oh, stand up. You can't read the exclamation points sitting down. We want to be Christians. Christians, formed into the image of Christ. We don't want to be stoics, mind only. We don't want to be fanatics, emotional energy only. We want a convergence. So let's sing this song to the Lord again. This Be Still. What a great song to do both of these things.